Good morning. You look awesome. I have missed you. Got to travel last weekend and wasn't here. A week ago Thursday, I was with Greg and Len Neeson. Spent the afternoon with them. They send you their love. They're doing really well. A year and a half ago, when Greg first called us and said, I have pancreatic cancer, stage 4, and it's already spread to my liver. We assumed that meant weeks or months before we'd be having his funeral. He reports that his cancer has not grown a single millimeter in that year and a half. Hasn't shrunk either, but it has not grown a single millimeter. It still can hurt him. So a month or two after that, I called him up, and I wasn't able to get down to see him. He was swamped with decisions anyway and all that. And so I called him on the phone. Greg, how you doing? I'm doing well, Robert. Greg, how are you doing? He said, my faith has never been stronger. I'm doing awesome. My faith has never been stronger. The Lord's with me, and I'm doing great. He said the same thing last week. There's 100 other stories involving him and Len, but they have a big smile on their face, and they love serving the church in Nikiski. When I called him up to see when was a good day to visit him, he had to shut off the dozer because he was plowing the parking lot, leveling out the Nikiski church parking lot. He says he feels much better when he's out working. Sitting still, it begins to hurt a bit, but he loves to get out and work. He feels awesome when he does that. So on the weekend, Friday and Saturday, we had a preacher's conference where ministers from all, preachers from all around the state gathered together, and Homer hosted it this year. Nikiski had it last year. And that was good, and a lot of love and unity there. And then on the way back, I got to stop and visit with Jake and Christina and the girls and visit the church in Seward. So a lot of contact, a lot of connection, and a lot of people send you their love and thanks, and it is a joy to be able to do that. Then yesterday, South Anchorage had a meeting on leadership, which was a good gathering, and that was a joy to be with. And at the end of the month, just to keep things, we need to stay connected to people. At the end of the month, brothers, 30th and 31st is the men's retreat. I encourage you to carve out some time to be able to go to that. Connecting with your brothers and sisters, and that weekend, your brothers, around the state is a powerful thing to do and does us a lot of good. So what discourages you? Let's turn to 1 Kings 19. From where does discouragement come from? And what should we do about it? You'd think having a tremendous amount of success, especially right in the face of your enemy, would keep you from discouragement. You would expect that something that was very successful that you had participated in which God and your connection to God and God's promises are demonstrated powerfully, that would keep one away from discouragement. But in fact, immediately after Elijah's participation in God's victory over the prophets of Baal, immediately after that, Jezebel, the queen, is furious with Elijah and says, may the gods do to me even more if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow at this time. Basically, within the next 24 hours, Elijah, I'm going to have you killed like God did to the prophets of Baal. And in 1 Kings 19, verse 3, he was afraid and rose and ran for his life. He went a day's journey into the wilderness, verse 4, and came and sat down under a juniper tree and requested for himself that he might die and said, it is enough now, O Lord, take my life, for I am no better than my father's. The distance between success and encouragement and discouragement. Think about those two words, encouragement and discouragement. One provides a fertile ground for courage. One destroys, weakens, and undercuts courage. When you encourage somebody, you're literally lifting up the platform for their courage to stand. And when you discourage somebody, you're knocking that out from underneath their courage and giving them a reason to focus on failure, to focus on weakness, to focus on sorrow and a poor future. Thank you, Isaac. So down in verse 9, after Elijah hides himself, he came to a cave and lodged there, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him. And God says to Elijah, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He said, "I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts. The sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword. And I..." What's the word there? Alone. I alone am left. Listen, if you want, and somebody wants to open up the windows along the side, it's a little warm in here, so please feel free to crank the windows open. This is not a performance or any kind of a show. This is a gathering of family, so please crank open the windows, get some fresh air in here. Makes me think of the huge ductwork in the new building that's going to bring fresh air into the auditorium all the time. Wouldn't that be nice? Room to have many more join us in fresh air. You know, being able to gather together on the first day of the week and listen and think with our minds, I hesitate on. I love the fact that we have a projector and our words are in front of us and principal points of the lessons are in front of us. But I also love the fact that we listen to the word and we read the written word and we think with our own minds. That we're not told what to think by some video or by some a set of pictures or some documentary. That we think and read for ourselves. We do that as a group. We listen to something, hopefully, that has a series of ideas and comes to a conclusion. That we sing together with our hearts. This is a special time that we get to do this every week, and it builds us in special ways. But Elijah was alone. He says, "I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away." So what discourages you? Every person, every human runs into discouragement, sometimes terribly serious discouragement. Personal rejection, loneliness like Elijah is doing here. Personal success, like Elijah had, that nobody notices. You ever done something really well? Something at work? And nobody notices? You want to nudge somebody and say, "Hey, did you notice? Did you?" I remember a job I had years ago, and the boss came down the hallway and stuck his head. I'd been there for a year or more, and stuck his head in the office. It was not mine, it was several people, but I always had a desk in the corner, and he said, "Hey, Robert, nice letter, appreciate it." And he kept walking down the hallway. And I went, "Wow, nice letter. He liked my letter. I wrote him a letter design, and he liked it." And I was kind of, you know, just sort of feeling great about it, and I realized, that's the first time that man has ever said I did something good. how many months have I been here? And it turned the thing around. Not that it didn't discourage me, but it turned it around a bit. It opened my eyes a bit that, hey, I hadn't thought about it, but this man doesn't particularly have a strength in that area to notice. That's not one of his strong points. So sometimes you can have success and do things well, and it kind of gets jerked out from under you because either nobody uses it, nobody appreciates it, nobody notices it. But on the other hand, personal failure is a biting discouragement. I should have. Had a wonderful phone call yesterday with George. George calls from Texas or wherever he is, and they were on a bus when he called yesterday. They'd been in Arizona for a while, and George loves to check in, told me several stories about some neat things that had gone on while they'd been down in Phoenix working with a church down there. But he also said that there was a discouraging point, and he said it really hit him hard. So we talked that through. And it's interesting on how this entire weekend of connection with people and encouraging classes for children and out in the community talking to people, all of that seemed to be overshadowed by this one point of discouragement. An entire weekend of encouraging connections and encouraging actions, and this one point of difficulty rose up and it dominated the middle part of our conversation. Yesterday in the leadership conference down in South Anchorage, the teacher said, and think about this in your relationships, the teacher said, psychologically, people will think about a negative event 5 times more than they'll think about a positive event. Something went wrong between you and somebody else, a snappy comment between a husband and a wife, a slammed door at the office, whatever it is. That will be remembered and focus on 5 times more than all of the good job, I love you, this project went well. The negative's remembered, and it's held on to sometimes for years. I haven't forgot what you said about me. Wow. I thought we'd cleared that. I'm really sorry. That's still. See, discouragement can dig into us and cling to us in a way that's out of balance with what's really going on. Sometimes we're discouraged by general wrong or sins when wrong wins the day. When things that shouldn't win do win. They shouldn't have passed that law. The courts shouldn't have decided that issue that way. Why is that government making that decision? Political wrong can bring about discouragement. Political corruption, political opinions can bring about discouragement. I've heard already, are we a year out from our election? Not yet a year from the presidential election. And they're already lining up. If this person is elected, I'm moving out of the country. That's it. I'm gone. I'm leaving. If this person is elected, on the opposite end of the spectrum, a bunch of people are like, I'm moving out. I'm leaving. That's it. I'm done. We got a year to go. I have to turn off some of my news connections. War and violence, all of that can lead to discouragement. It's no wonder that Paul tells the Philippians how beautiful their thoughts ought to be, what they ought to focus on, what they ought to dwell on. All of the lovely and the beautiful and the joyous and the good, where we ought to focus our thoughts. But the bad and the evil gets its claws into us. And it doesn't quit. There's always something else that'll clobber you. Last week, Roberta Edwards, some of you know that name, Roberta Edwards was killed in Haiti. Roberta Edwards worked with a mission program from the Estes Church of Christ out of Henderson, Tennessee. Her activities in Haiti were taking care of children. She's 55 years old, a beautiful lady. The preacher from her home congregation said she had an unwavering love of God, love of her children, and love of the people of Haiti. And she was shot in her car. And after reading the story, it seems deliberate. Because she and three little boys were in that car, little guys, and they killed her and kidnapped one of the children. This little boy had been cared for by Roberta since he was 9 months old, and now I think he was 7 or 8. Discouragement rises up. It's not right. A beautiful lady like that doing beautiful work on the front line of the fight against evil. She's doing what the New Testament tells us is the most powerful, most purposed, the sharpest, the best of the work. Take care of widows and orphans. You want to do good work? Show the love of God to those who are unloved. Give the hope of God to those who don't have hope. And here this wonderful lady was out there year after year serving and taking care of little children. She had 20 or so that lived in her house, and she fed 2 times a day another 20 or 100, 120 or 140 twice a day out of her kitchen. A story like that can dig into you, can kind of undercut, our confidence. But it only lasts if we ignore our Heavenly Father. It doesn't last if we go back to Him. God's asking Elijah, what are you doing here? He says, I'm all alone. He said, I can tell you're all alone. He said, no, I'm really all alone. There's nobody else in Israel paying attention to you. Down to verse 18, God says, effectively, you're wrong, Elijah. Yet I leave 7,000, verse 18 of 1 Kings 19. I leave 7,000 in Israel whose knees have not bowed to Baal and their mouths have not kissed him. You're not alone, Elijah. You're alone because you put yourself in this cave. But you're not alone in your walk with me. You're not alone in your faith to me. You're not alone in your honoring to me. You're not alone in your obedience to me. I have thousands who stand with you, Elijah. This reminds me of a well-told story about a Civil War battlefield in which the defending army, true story, defending army was up on a ridge line, dug in, thick with trees. They outnumbered, the defending army outnumbered the attacking army. Now, that's way out of whack. Because the defending army needs much less to defeat a larger force. But they outnumbered the attacking army. They were thick in a tree line, dug into their positions, and here came the the aggressors. Here came the attacking army up the hill. They had to climb the ridge to get to the defensives. So everything favors the defenders, except that the thickness of the trees made every little entrenchment feel isolated. They had an entire line of foxholes and dug-in entrenchments, but in that line, they couldn't see the rest of their soldiers. They couldn't see the rest of their regiments. They couldn't see who they were on that line with. And as the attacking army fought their way up the hill, they turned and ran because they felt alone. They felt it was just them fighting these regiments coming up the hill toward them. And even though everything about the battle favored their position, they lost the battle because they ran. They ran out of ignorance. And really, that's one of the most overwhelming aspects of what to grab for in the face of discouragement. Give ourselves more information, the truth of our Heavenly Father. Elisha had to learn that he wasn't alone. Long way from being alone, Elisha. There are thousands upon thousands who stand with you for me, Elisha. Elisha was feeling sorry for himself in a very serious way. But you know, this story goes all over the Bible. Joseph, the beautiful story about Joseph sold into slavery by his own brothers. The last time he had contact with his family was as his hands are tied, being dragged away by a caravan going down to Egypt. Huh? What an encouragement that is. The people who love you the most cast you off as a slave. James, one of the precious 12 apostles, one of the three that Jesus pulled closest to himself, James is the first one executed, the first one to die for no reason at all. Herod wanted to please the Jews, so he put him to the sword. Hey, it pleased him so much, he went and arrested Peter. And that's the famous story about Peter being led out by the angel out of prison. So Peter wasn't executed, but James was. God, didn't you like James? Why did you let him be killed? There are lots of other people you could have martyred. Why did... Arguing with God. Arguing with God. We have a better idea than you do, God. We think it should have been done differently. Stephen. Stephen, the good teacher, the courageous man, who gets stoned to death in Acts, who caused the persecution started with killing Stephen, caused the entire congregation in Jerusalem, all the Christians in Jerusalem, to scatter. Now some stayed in the city, but the point is that all of their gatherings, all their groups were scattered across the countryside, and they fled up and down the Mediterranean and out into the hills. That's discouraging. Except that everywhere they went, they preached the gospel. I wrote to one of the preachers in the state thinking about Roberta's death, about how wrong that is. A woman whose only crime is to care for little boys, little children, to feed orphans and give them a loving home. I hope that that stirs hearts so that there are dozens of willing Christians to go take her place. Far from discouraging people away from Haiti, it'll stir hearts that many will go stand in her place to love children. We'll have the courage, the encouragement to do that. But one of my favorite stories about hopelessness, real hopelessness, is in 2 Kings 7. If you want to turn there with me, look at 2 Kings. You want hopeless? You want discouragement, they're thick with it. They're deep into it. 2 Kings chapter 7. At the end of 2 Kings 6, at the end of 2 Kings 6, not Elijah, but Elisha is being threatened by the king of Israel. And the messenger of the king of Israel, the last sentence of chapter 6 in 2 Kings is really telling. Because the end of the last verse in chapter 6 reads, "Why should I wait for the Lord any longer?" I'm not waiting for God. That's it. I'm done. Yikes. Why should I wait for the Lord any longer? What's going on is that Israel up in Samaria is being surrounded by the Arameans. King Ben-Hadad of the Arameans has sieged the city, and they're starving to death. If you want to know how badly they're starving to death, put cannibalism in the list, and you'll catch on a bit. Bird droppings were part of their diet, but I'll let you read for 2 Kings 6 if you want to read that on your own time. I mean, they were really, really desperate. They had resorted to cannibalism. And Elisha says in the first verse of chapter 7, "Listen to the word of the Lord. Tomorrow about this time, a measure of fine flour will be sold for a shekel, and 2 measures of barley for a shekel at the gate." Ha! Elijah, you've gone mad. Elisha, you've gone mad. There's not even any flour in the city, much less finding it at market prices. And then we change gears to the 4 lepers. I love this story because of the logic and the simplicity of these 4 men and how God uses 4 outcasts to teach the entire people a lesson. Now, there were 4 leprous men at the entrance of the gate. Verse 3 of 2 Kings 7. They said to one another, "Why do we sit here until we die? If we say, 'We'll enter the city,' then the famine is in the city and we'll die there. If we sit here, we'll die here. Now, therefore, come, let us go over to the camp of the Arameans. If they spare us, we'll live. If they kill us, we'll die." Now, that's logic. We've got 3 choices: death, death, and probable death. We sit here, we're going to die. We go in the city, everybody's dying in the city, we'll join them and die there. If we go meet the enemy, they'll probably kill us. But they might not. Now there's hope. Isn't that an awesome way to grab onto some hope? Death, death, and probable death. Okay, we'll take the probable death. Lauren told us a story. I got his permission to tell this the other night. When he was in Vietnam, talk about serious events, his special operations teams would be out in the jungles, and several times they would walk into an ambush. Explosives, punji stakes, enemy in the wood line, and you're standing in a killing zone. You walk into an ambush, and the enemy... just everything opens fire. Noise, explosions, just instant terror. Went from silence to so loud you can't think. If you stay where you are, you're going to die. If you move forward, there's a more trap in front of you, you're going to die. If you run away from the enemy, they got traps along there, you're going to die. Every choice you have, except one, is death. What you do, the only way out of that, is to charge the enemy. Every other direction, it's an ambush, thank you. Because it's an ambush, they have every direction blocked off, guaranteed to kill you. And so you get trained that the only thing to do in an ambush is charge the enemy. then you'll just probably die. But the reality was, what would it be like if you caught somebody in an ambush and they turned with their weapons going and they charge you? What are you going to do? That's exactly what the enemy did. They ran. And although this happened to him over and over again, we have him sitting here with us. That's an instantaneous analysis of what these guys were going through as they sat in the gate. Death, death, and probable death. We'll take the probable death. So they get up. They get up. They arose, verse 5, to go into the camp of the Arameans. And when they came to the outskirts of the city of the camp, behold, there was no one there. God, as the verse explains, the following verses explain, had caused a noise of moving chariots and armies to come upon them during the night. And the Arameans talked themselves into them being surrounded. They thought that the Egyptians and others had been hired by the Israelites and that they were going to be attacked in the morning. And so the Arameans ran for their lives in the darkness when there was no one there. And so the verse 8, when the lepers came to the outskirts of the camp, they entered one tent and ate and drank and carried silver and gold and clothes and went and hid them. And they returned and entered another tent and carried from there also, and they went and hid them. And then they said to one another, we're not doing right. This isn't right. The day is a day of good news, but we're keeping silent. If we wait until morning, punishment will overtake us. Therefore, let us go and tell the king's household. So they go back. Can you imagine four lepers walking up? The city's dying of hunger. And these four guys, who nobody wants to get anywhere close, comes in and says, there's nobody out there. No, really, they're gone. Well, they didn't believe them. So the king sent an envoy, sent someone out to check, and indeed, of course, the attacking army was gone. And people went rushing out of the gates and ate themselves full and took the gold and the clothes. I mean, the Arameans had left their horses. They had left their weapons. They ran for their lives because God had confused them so much. Why should I wait on the Lord any longer? There's a reason to wait on the Lord. You see, in every one of those stories, whether it's Joseph or James or Stephen or David, who should have been king and was running for his life to place after place after place, or these sieges extreme hunger, what was missing for most of them is awareness that all of this is in the hand of God. Do not believe the discouragements. Whenever you get discouraged, realize that you are basically in a type of trap. You're dealing with fear when God says, do not fear, but be courageous. You're dealing with fatigue, tiredness, when God says, let me give you rest, or Jesus specifically promises us rest. You're dealing with frustration because things aren't changing the way you want, or maybe politically or whatever, and God says, I've got this. Put your trust in me. You're dealing with loneliness. I think I'm the only one who's got this figured out. Nobody else, when God has given you a church family to be with. You're dealing with failure when God offers you forgiveness and victory. Whatever is discouraging you, you're not eating bird droppings for your meals. You're not expecting to die this week because the enemy of a horrific king is surrounding your home. And even there, God says, I've got you. I've got you. Just wait on me. Be intentional Understand who you are and whose you are. Get in your word. Read the word of God and see how he has rescued his people over and over and over again. Look for God working in your surroundings and join him. Put yourself to work. God is moving and active in this church and in this valley and in the state of Alaska. Join him in what he's doing. And never allow yourself to stay alone. Don't be alone. Discouragement can make you want to be alone. Discouragement can make you pull away from people, but don't let it happen. The Lord has given us a church to serve him in. So stay active with his church. Pull close to other Christians. Don't be alone. And if you see a Christian who's pulling away, trying to be alone, go give them a hug. Go encourage them. Go grab onto them and ask them out for a cup of coffee. This morning, if there's those here who have not been baptized into Christ, that's the first step to take to know this great victory that God has given to us, that he is in charge of all things in our lives, and that we need to wait on him and trust him. Don't let discouragement hold you down. If that's your need or any other need, please come forward while we stand and sing a song that Steve has chosen.